Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Robert Redfield has called face masks one of the most powerful weapons we have in the fight against COVID-19. Despite growing evidence that supports that claim, many in the public have expressed skepticism and confusion. Mark Weir is an environmental engineer and professor with the Ohio State University College of Public Health. He co-directs the Ecology, Epidemiology, and Population Health Program at the OSU Infectious Diseases Institute. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How do you approach the question of face mask effectiveness from an engineering point of view?
So, from an engineering point of view, it's basically like a two-way filter. You have the droplets and any aerosols that are being generated from a cough or a sneeze or a loud speaking that's being blocked by the inner surface of the mask. And on the outer surface of the mask, any droplets or aerosols that you come into contact with in your daily life are being blocked or filtered through that mask.
With that said, what should a basic mask be made of? What should constitute a basic mask to achieve that two-way filter?
So there's been a lot of research has been going into masks, especially of late. And in general, what you want to have is you want to have multiple layers of material, and the material itself. What we typically see is cotton poly blends seem to have a better overall effectiveness, being able to block or otherwise be able to impact the droplets or the aerosols better. But you want multiple layers. So single layer, double layer is, double layer is better than single layer, triple layer is better than double or single. And once you go beyond triple, it's just becoming too hard to breathe typically, especially if you're going to have any kind of exertion. So that's typically where we stop evaluating after double or triple layer.
A recent study out of Duke University made headlines with findings that seem to suggest that neck gaiters might actually do more harm than good. And I'm seeing a lot more neck gaiters. Those are the things you can kind of just pull up from around your neck up over your face. What are your thoughts about that?
So in general, looking at the study that they conducted, in our study a little while back, when we looked at the risk reduction, we didn't actually look at neck gaiters specifically, but we did look at single layer protection. And really, their results aren't surprising from what we were looking at as well, where a single layer really isn't properly protective. I mean, neck gaiters are an attractive option because they're nice and easy. It's around your neck to be able to pull it up as you need to. But when what's basically happening is there's an ad hoc trade-off between convenience and effectiveness in that case. So what basically the way I would agree with what the Duke study was saying is that it's giving you this false sense of security that you can engage in typical activities or socially distanced activities and have this increased layer of safety by wearing the gaiter, when in reality, it's not really presenting that. So you're possibly engaging in more exposure events, thinking that you have a layer of protection when you really don't.
Giving you that false sense of security, so to speak.
Yep.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with Mark Weir. He's an environmental engineer and an assistant professor at the OSU College of Public Health, and we're talking about face masks and, how they're made and which ones work and which ones don't work so well. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We see some of the masks on the market have built-in valves for, I don't know exactly what to call them. They look like they're like air holes and you can open them or shut them. What are the pros and what are those for, and are they for this?
No, so they are definitely not for this. So the point of the masks is not only your protection, but everyone else's. So there is still something called an asymptomatic carriers or asymptomatic person. So you could have a very, very mild form of COVID-19, not really know it and be able to spread it. You could also be carrying it and shedding it and spreading it. and not have any symptoms at all. So the idea behind the masks is that there's one layer of protection for the people who are possibly spreading it, and then there's also the protection for people who don't have it and don't want to get it, obviously. The valve is there for is it's a one-way valve. It's basically a little rubber flap that's on that little plastic housing at the front of the mask. It's supposed to be able to allow you to be able to exhale easier through an N95. So you're not pushing air through the material itself. Mm-hmm. So when you're doing work, especially, physical labor kind of work and outside, you can have this buildup of moisture and increased pressure on the inside of the mask. And that could actually damage the seal around your face. So the idea behind the valve is to limit that bad outcome of breathing through it. But then the valve shuts immediately as soon as you start breathing in.
Okay.
What's happening in this case for what we're talking about is that one of those two-way streets, the preventing people from contaminating the environment or spreading the virus is blown away, basically, by having this jet of aerosols coming out through that valve.
I wear a KN95 without a valve, and one of the things I like about it is it's like three-dimensional. It pulls away. It sets away from my mouth. Is there a pro and con to having a mask up against your mouth or away from your mouth like the KN95s are?
So from what my lab has been able to look at so far, there's limited information to be able to talk about the closeness of a mask being any kind of additional risk to the wearer. Mm-hmm. The KN95, similar to an N95, is a respirator as opposed to a mask. We don't call them respirators in the United States because the separation between a KN95 and an N95 is that the Chinese government has very, very similar, if not almost the same, requirements for certification, but we don't certify those through NIOSH here in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's really the main difference between them. That's why it says not for clinical use or for medical use or healthcare environments, because it's not been certified by NIOSH to be an N95. That's mm-hmm. why it's also called a KN95. The point of that barrier, that kind of air gap, is that it is harder to be able to move air forward and through that material, and that allows you to be able to breathe a little bit easier when you're wearing that kind of a respirator or. And a KN95, can't really call it a respirator in the United States. We just still call it a mask.
Right.
So there are some of us, in my lab included, who are looking at trying to see, does it matter how close that mask is? Because what you'll have is you're not just expelling, it's not, when somebody coughs or sneezes, it's not just the virus or bacteria that they're infected with at that time that comes out. There's a whole host of bacteria that will be in what's called a bioaerosol, and droplets are just a larger diameter type of bioaerosol, basically. And so you will have bacteria build up on the inside of the mask as a potential outcome, especially the more you use it. So mm-hmm. having that much closer to your mouth can increase risks of lip infections or other outcomes, but we're not really sure how large a risk that is just yet.
How important is it? I'm always bugging people to get the mask up over their nose, and or it's down at the tip of their nose, and it drives me insane. And how important is it to have it up over the nose, over that bridge of your nose in all of this?
It is close to half of the effectiveness of the mask. So if you just cover your mouth and you're not covering your nose, you can still inhale aerosols or droplets through your nose, and you can still have bioaerosols come out through your nose, especially if you have a sneeze, or in some cases, if you have a lot of projection through your nose when you're speaking as well. There's a really very interesting German study that looked at, and it wasn't actual bioaerosols from an infection. They basically just had a smoke mist come out from stingers, and you can see the pattern of how aerosols will come out through a nose as well as a person's mouth whenever they're talking.
So, and as far as keeping your mask cleaner? How often should, so we see all the handmade or the homemade, I should say, masks out there, and they're just popping up everywhere, masks in stores. I was in a toy store the other day and saw masks for children. So the typical two or three ply cotton poly blend masks, how often should you wash it?
I mean, I wouldn't go more than 1 or 2 days without putting it in the laundry or putting it directly in the washer and waiting for when you would do your laundry mm-hmm. next. There's a couple things that go with what the mask material is. One is that it's what's called a non-porous fomite or it's a porous fomite or a porous surface. So it has the ability to absorb in moist materials. It's harder to be able to get a virus off of the surface of a porous fomite as compared to a non-porous one like a desk surface. So if you take the mask off and you wash your hands after you put it into the laundry machine mm-hmm. or the washing machine, then that's a safe way of being able to make sure that you can do that. In general, the warmer the water, the more effectiveness you're going to be able to have by way of reducing the virus amount overall. I wouldn't go too hot because then you risk shrinking things and you just have to buy more masks. And if it comes with manufacturer suggested instructions, those are basically to maintain the integrity of the material. So follow the recommended or instructed washing instructions, and the soap or the detergent that you use in your washing machine will have an effectiveness on the virus, and then just removing it from the surface and going down the drain line is going to do that as well.
Hand wash?
If it recommends that you hand wash, then hand wash.
Okay.
There isn't really very much information about whether or not you would be aerosolizing anything from the sink as you're washing it, but that typically requires a relatively robust amount of energy to be able to aerosolize things in a large amount of water, especially if you're washing it. Just wash your hands after you're done doing that and putting it to dry. But I would suggest putting it in a washing machine if you can.
Yeah. And as far as like the KN95s and those kinds of masks, it's the same thing, just they're only good for a couple days, or it depends?
It depends on how long you're wearing it. If you're wearing it the majority of the day or essentially all day, I would consider those one and done. And then if it is very intermittent wearing, then you can consider your own preference about how you tolerate risks to decide whether or not you want to continue wearing it. The way they're constructed, the surface is where the contaminant is going to reside, unless you are asymptomatic and shedding, and then the interior surface mm-hmm. will also be contaminated. But in general, again, what it comes down to is manufacturers suggested practices with them. And if it's heavily used, I wouldn't use it more than once a day.
You know, some people have made a habit of hanging their masks from the car's rearview mirror. You see them all the time now to keep it handy. Is that a good idea? How do you store the mask between, you know, you don't wear it in the car if you're alone. How do you store it? What do you think?
So I just put mine in the center console or the glove box outside up. That way the outside of the mask isn't touching anything else that I would touch in the center console or in the glove box. In one of my cars, we just have a larger center console, and that's basically all that's in that center console right now is the mask that I'm wearing. I actually worry more about the masks dangling from rearview mirrors from a driver distraction standpoint than really anything else. You're not really going to get re-aerosolization or resuspension of the virus from the surface of the mask while you're driving, more likely than not. So I would just be cognizant of where the outer surface of the mask is, what that's touching, and then you could probably just have it on your passenger seat or in a center console.
A couple months ago, I talked with folks from Battelle about a cleaning process that they had devised. What do we know about how that's working? And is there any way people can get their own KN95s or their own masks cleaned that way?
So I'm not sure about how effective that process is. It's a really good question. I wouldn't be comfortable answering on that one. I just don't really know. I'm not really sure. The what I do know about the unit or the technology is that it's a really quite a robust system. It's a big system.
Yeah.
So unless there was a commercial, like an entrepreneur who wanted to be able to make that available, I don't think I would see how that would be possible.
Okay. For everyday people. And then some people have asked about, well, can you spray bleach on your masks or something like that to disinfect them in between?
No, I would not recommend doing anything like that. So I've heard something similar, like there's the 24-hour residual spray disinfectant that is out there, as well as just spray disinfectants and bleach. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of things that will happen with regards to that. One, especially with bleach, you're going to degrade the surface properties of the material itself. So you're going to change how that actually filters the air as it's coming in, especially if you're using something like a KN95. It is specifically designed to have surface characteristics of the material. You're going to ruin that by putting those products on there.
Okay.
The Patel system is a very specifically engineered system to be able to do that. The other thing is if you're consistently coating something that is very close contact with your respiratory system in your mouth, you will be ingesting those chemicals until that's no longer, like especially that 24-hour surface retention type of products. And we don't know what kind of long-term health effects there would be from doing that to yourself.
All right. Mark Weir, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Mark Weir is an environmental engineer and assistant professor at the OSU College of Public Health. We've been talking about mask safety, face mask safety. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Aerobic exercise has long been understood to improve emotional well-being. Think the runner's high of endurance athletes. Far less research has been done to evaluate the power of strength training to ease the symptoms of depression. But the signs are promising that weightlifting can not only build muscle, but elevate mood. Jason Sawyer is an exercise physiology professor at Rhode Island College, where he coordinates the school's wellness and exercise science major program. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, the difference, the physiological difference between aerobic exercise and weightlifting, is there anything of note there?
Sure, absolutely. So, with aerobic exercise, you're obviously going to activate the aerobic system more. So you're going to typically have a higher heart rate, a higher respiratory rate, whereas strength training is going to elevate the metabolism inside the muscles that you're using. So for example, let's say you're doing a bodyweight squat. So what would happen is we would see an increase in metabolism in those muscles that are actually being used. So the quadriceps, the hamstrings, the glutes, we'd see an uptick in metabolism.
And, you know, when I do weight training or strength training, I should say, I can get out of breath. Yeah. It feels aerobic sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. And that's going to depend very heavily on the rest periods. So if you can decrease rest periods, you are going to activate the cardiovascular system even more.
Okay. Thanks to my boot camp teachers on that score.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So strength training has been researched less than cardiovascular exercise, you know, such as running, you know, whatever. Why is that? Is there a reason that you know?
That is a great question. I think it's twofold. Whenever we talk about exercise as it pertains to an increase in the quality of life, the longevity of life, or just for its overall health benefits, typically we emphasize the aerobic training, right? So a healthy heart typically leads to a healthier person. What we're starting to understand now, though, is that the muscular system, So the system that is directly trained through strength training is possibly just as important as cardiovascular health. And in terms of research, it's much easier to have somebody, to tell somebody, okay, please go run on the treadmill for 20 minutes, compared to resistance training where, okay, are we going to use free weights? Are we going to use machines? To borrow your example, are we going to have them do a boot camp? And at what percentage of their one repetition maximum are we going to have them lift? So it's also just much easier to use aerobic exercise in research.
So the question is then, what do we know about the relative effectiveness to address or combat issues such as depression and anxiety? There's been a lot of study on aerobic exercise on that score. What are we learning about strength exercise? And by the way, maybe you could explain, you know, we've already mentioned some varieties, but just to be clear that people know what we're talking about, what we mean by strength training is everything from push-ups to weightlifting, right?
Absolutely. So we would include anything from calisthenics. So there's your push-ups, jumping jacks, even body weight squats, mm-hmm. all the way up to, you know, using a barbell or dumbbell to strength train. So anything in between there, we would consider strength training. Machines is another great example of what can be used for strength training. And where we're at right now is it seems that strength training is just as effective for improving overall mood. So when I say that, I mean decreasing depression and anxiety as aerobic training. Now, again, there has not been as much research, but it does seem that resistance training is just as effective. And interestingly, there was just a study that was published in 2019. And so what we're looking for is changes in areas of the brain that regulate mood, namely the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's two different pathways in order for us to change the hippocampus in the brain. Aerobic training uses one pathway, and at least in rats, strength training uses another pathway. So when I explain this, I like to say, compare it to having two different jobs, right? Your end goal of having two different jobs is to make more money. Our end goal in exercise as it relates to mental disorder or mental illness is to increase hippocampus size. Now, these two jobs lead you to the same thing, making more money. It seems that resistance training and aerobic training take you to the same place, changing the hippocampus, but by two different pathways. So I am very excited. I think what we're going to see is that aerobic, in addition to resistance training, is going to be the new recommendation for improving mood.
And people might say, well, why does this matter? I mean, if we already know that aerobic works, everybody can just do aerobic, why worry about whether strength works? But it does matter because not everybody can go run 3 miles.
Precisely. And not everybody likes to do a lot of aerobic work. So, aerobic exercise, if you're dreading it, it is my experience that people will do it less. So if you really like to lift weights rather than train aerobically, you can do that and still get some of the mood elevating effects of exercise.
You've conducted some small scale studies involving groups of students with depressive symptoms. How did you do these and what did you learn?
Sure, absolutely. So there was two small studies, and one was a chronic study. So individuals participate in a strength training program for 6 weeks, and we measured pre and post depression levels. And this was a partnership with our counseling center that we have on campus. And so the lead counselor would recommend that an individual who may be suffering from depression reaches out to me. Again, it was totally voluntary. Mm-hmm. And then I would set them up with a trainer and they would participate in resistance training. And what we saw through this chronic study was that individuals did have a decrease in overall depression after the 6 weeks. And some anecdotal evidence, one subject shared with me that she just felt better about herself. She felt more relaxed and overall less depressed. The other study we conducted was an acute study. So I personally suffer from depression. And one of the things that I have found that if I feel myself going down a road of depression or anxiety is that I can go work out and typically I feel better right after. So I wanted to test this scientifically and see, does an acute bout of exercise reduce depression and anxiety, namely resistance training? So we used college-aged individuals. And what we found is that individuals right after they worked out had improvement in mood, which is very powerful to me because not only does it work chronically, but it also can be used acutely.
So that's long-term and short-term.
Correct. So it does seem to have some protective effects. We use long-term, so 6 to 8 weeks. And it also can be used, you know, if you're just kind of feeling a little depressed, it seems like resistance training will improve your mood afterwards.
Right. So are you thinking about ways to incorporate this into lifestyle, like, you know, doing planks a couple times a day? It's not a super high exertion, but it is a good resistance exercise, a good core exercise, and it could just elevate your mood.
Yeah, absolutely. If there's one thing that I hope comes across during this interview is that there was a study done in the early 2000s that compared the effectiveness of two different types of resistance training. So high intensity and low intensity. Mm-hmm. So working really, really hard, lifting as much weight as you possibly can, and then comparing that to low intensity. So something like a plank or push-ups. And what this study found was that you got more benefits at higher intensity. Mm-hmm. So if you work out at 80% of your 1RM, your one rep max, you got a higher mood elevation than the lower intensity. But the lower intensity, the 20% group, still had an improvement in mood. So even doing a little bit, you can feel better. You know, I joke with my students, I say, just do more than nothing. If you can just do something, step ups on the stairs, squats, planks, push-ups, something, it has been shown that it will improve mood.
You're working with younger people. Is there any curiosity about how this manifests for older people?
Absolutely. And that's actually where a bulk of the research has been done. Individuals with Parkinson's, dialysis, MS, individuals in retirement homes. The reason that I'm using college age individuals at 18 to 22 year old is because most typically the first depressive episode for an individual occurs between the ages of 18 and 25. So typically somebody who suffers from depression, their first episode happens somewhere around 18. So my thought is, if I can use this demographic in my studies, then we can recommend and start to help these individuals at a younger age and hopefully avoid when they get older. So many depressive episodes. It does, even in individuals in the eighth and ninth decades, that have been used in studies, exercise, specifically resistance training, has been shown to improve mood.
And it's a good age to get someone started on a lifestyle of exercise.
Precisely.
Right. Have you been measuring, or did you just not even pay attention to this as far as muscle gain goes? Now, again, if you're in your 20s, your early 20s, your late teens, early 20s, you get a lot more bang for your buck when it comes to muscle gain than you do when you're not.
Yes, absolutely.
I've learned that.
And so it seems that the improvement in mood is not related to the amount of muscle mass or the amount of strength gain. So it seems that it's independent. So it doesn't matter if you get stronger or have more muscle, you can still get the same elevations in mood. Now, I do think, of course, you know, you start to see a little bit of muscle, so that motivates you a little bit more.
Yeah.
But it's still independent of that.
When we're talking about that pathway that strength training makes to the brain, the area of the brain that affects the mood, is that what are we talking about? That protein in the brain called BDNF, or is that the same protein that aerobic exercise triggers?
Yeah, so we are speaking of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is BDNF. So the end goal for exercise in terms of improving mood is increasing the size of the hippocampus, right? And that's what antidepressants typically do, right? So you're on a SSRI. The reason that they work is because they increase hippocampal size. This is what aerobic and what resistance training does. Aerobic typically relies on BDNF, while it seems that, and again, this is in rats, so we need to be cautious when we look at this, but it seems like it might use another pathway, which is the IGF pathway, to increase that hippocampus size. But if we can find two different ways to increase hippocampal size, that can lead to a more profound effect. And I think the combination of the two is going to be the most bang for your buck, like you said earlier.
Well, Jason Sawyer, I want to thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Jason Sawyer is an assistant professor of wellness and exercise science at Rhode Island College, and he's studying the research and doing his own research to evaluate the power of strength training to ease the symptoms of depression and anxiety. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so I hope you'll stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Doctors are calling it the post-COVID syndrome, a catch-all term to describe the lingering poor health experienced by those recovering from the illness. Up to 60% of people who have recovered from the acute phase of COVID-19 still have persistent fatigue, even months afterward. But it goes beyond tiredness, and it can affect all parts of the body. And for some, there may be no bouncing back to full health. Dr. John Swartzberg is chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you.
You know, this is a topic that comes up a lot, and that is that you note that there are no experts in novel coronavirus. It's novel. It's new. Everyone's learning together. But 8 months in, we have started to suss out this COVID syndrome. What started to raise eyebrows first?
Sure. Well, you know, when this started, we've known for decades that coronaviruses cause respiratory disease, like colds and coughs, sometimes fevers. We did know that in 2001, 2002, there was SARS that was a coronavirus, but that was unusual. And then there was MERS and 2012, and that was unusual. But when this started, everybody, including me, we thought it was going to be just like flu. It's just going to be another respiratory virus. And initially, it looked like that. Some people got really sick. Tragically, some people died. But most people just got what looked like either a bad cold or a bad cough, sometimes with fever. So that was the model that we had in our minds. But then we started to see things that just didn't quite fit with that. The really serious, what we call now the cytokine storm, or the inflammation that caused so much damage. And that was unusual during the acute illness. But during the recovery period, we were starting to see things that were disturbing. And that's what led to this idea that, you know, this is very different than like a flu virus and other respiratory viruses. There's something more going on here. And the list is now, just 8 months into this pandemic, quite long for things that happen to people after they recover. That is, they recover from the acute illness, but they still have lingering problems. And that's what a lot of people are calling this post-COVID syndrome. And as you mentioned in your introduction, fatigue, depression, mental fogginess, that's really common now. It seems to occur in a lot of people up to a few months later.
And what do we mean by mental fogginess? I've heard exactly that term many times. And how debilitating is it?
It's like everything. It's on a spectrum from hardly debilitating at all to really debilitating. And we don't know much about it. And you know, it just like the name mental fogginess reflects, we're pretty foggy about what it really represents. And it may not represent just one phenomena, but it could represent a variety of things that manifest themselves in just your brain not being as sharp. I've talked to people who say that, you know, I feel okay, but I just can't do math like I used to, or I can't remember quite like I used to. Now, this is not the majority of people, but it's a lot of people who complain about this in their recovery. We have no idea how long it'll last.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask you. I mean, have we learned anything in the 8 months about any, even a correlation between the severity of the syndrome and how sick someone was in the first place during the acute phase?
It's a little hard to ferret that out. Because people who are really sick and are on a ventilator for a period of time, they're going to take a long time to recover, and
anyway,
they're going to be physically and mentally having trouble. That's right, anyway.
Yeah.
But we are seeing it in people who get COVID, don't need hospitalization. They might have a fever and a cough, but it goes away just like other respiratory illnesses do. But it leaves them somewhat debilitated. In general, we're seeing it more commonly occur the more sick people are. But again, you know, as you said at the beginning, there are no experts with COVID right now. It's too new, and we're all in the learning phase of this.
And that's what a lot of people, I think, are so frustrated with. They don't get it. How could we not know? How could we not know? Because this is a novel coronavirus. This is the first time most of us have ever confronted something that there aren't an expert out there to tell us what to do.
It's humbling for everybody, certainly for the scientists, certainly for politicians, certainly for the general public. It's very humbling. But, you know, this is the state that human beings have lived in forever. And we've been in this information age for a very short time, and we've gotten used to the fact that we can know anything by just Googling it. And people are starting to appreciate now that science is a process by which we can get to what nature is doing. But it's a process that takes time and is meticulous. And so we will learn all the answers to all of these things. But if you think about it in a simple way, the question is, if somebody's suffering from this, quote, brain fog, and they're not doing well, they want to know, well, how long is it going to last? Mm-hmm. Well, no one can tell you how long it's going to last because the virus has only been around for 8 months. So that's frustrating.
How do you define recovered when it comes to COVID-19?
Well, it depends. That's a very good question. Certainly, it's very easy to define recovery from the perspective of physiologic function. How well are your lungs working? Is your fever gone? Have you had any heart damage or not, et cetera? So those parameters we can monitor very carefully and be very meticulous about. But when you're talking about these more subtle things, it's very difficult to know what recovery is. And when we're talking about the brain, it becomes even more confounded by the fact that, well, you know, when I walk into a room and I can't remember why I walked into the room, what I wanted to get, the first thing that goes through my mind is, oh my gosh, am I developing Alzheimer's disease? So the brain starts reflecting on itself. So there's that phenomenon that goes on as well. So you start second-guessing yourself when you get that mental fog that we're talking about. It's complicated, but we will figure it out.
We're not usually talking about the brain when we consider a coronavirus, right?
No, we're not. But, you know, we're not usually talking about the heart when we think about coronavirus, and we're not talking about the GI tract when we think of coronavirus and the kidneys and so on. And that's the other thing that's been so interesting and so frightening, frankly, about this virus is particularly with the heart. We've documented very well now that people, even with very mild infections, can develop what we call myocarditis, or an inflammation of the muscle of the heart. And this can manifest itself up to 2 or 3 months later after the infection. And oftentimes it's silent. That is, people feel okay, but sometimes it's not. It can cause rhythm disturbances of the heart, and it can cause the heart not to pump as strongly. Where we're really concerned about this is with elite athletes, because if somebody's had coronavirus and then they feel fine, but they're going to really stress their heart afterwards, they could really have some serious consequences from that.
So even if I've had a mild case of COVID-19, is that something that, is there a growing list of issues that that family physicians need to start checking on after someone has, quote unquote, recovered?
There is a growing list. But I think that list is going to continue to grow, because it seems like every 2 to 4 weeks there's something new that we add on. I'm sure most of your listeners know about the pediatric syndrome of a multi-system inflammatory syndrome of children.
Yeah.
Now, not very common, fortunately, actually fairly rare. But when it occurs, it can be devastating. And that just came out of the blue. So the bottom line, we need a lot more time and a lot more work to understand this fascinating and disturbing dance that this virus has with human beings.
Has it been mislabeled a coronavirus?
Not taxonomically in terms of a virologist would. I mean, there's no question that this falls into the coronavirus family.
Because of what it looks like.
Because of what it looks like. These spike proteins all around it look like a crown or corona.
Okay.
But your question is really a great one, because as I said earlier, we've known about the 4 human coronaviruses that cause a common cold since the 1960s. And they cause about a quarter to a third of everybody's cold, so practically everybody's gotten them. And that's all we thought about coronaviruses. We didn't think it caused serious disease. Sure, on rare occasions it might be able to do that. But as I mentioned earlier, that SARS was the first inkling that there are viruses in that coronavirus family that do something different than just the common cold.
And then when it comes to children, I'm wondering, they don't get it at the same rate. In fact, it's the huge difference between children and adults, and then children and compromised adults with pre-existing conditions and so forth. But I'm wondering, is there any awareness about whether kids are getting it, they're not having any symptoms of it? And that something could be happening in the future, that there's damage being done, but they're just not noticing it.
Well, this is still a very confusing topic.
Okay.
There's a pretty good evidence that children, very young children, particularly under the age of 5, don't have as many what we call receptor sites for the virus. Viruses need to get inside our cells, and they find some proteins on the surface of our cells to use to get inside of our cells. Really, young children don't have very many of those, so they really shouldn't get infected as often. Yet other studies have shown that we can see the viral counts of children that are infected to be nearly comparable to that of older children and even young adults. So there's conflicting data there that we're still trying to sort out. The really important question that you're getting at is, well, what about getting sick? And I think that data is, I think everybody feels that there's a consensus on the fact that children just don't get sick as much as younger adults and older adults. It's unusual to see serious illness in children under the age of 19, particularly children under the age of 10. So there is something about being young and being able to handle this virus much better. To date, we have not seen serious long-term consequences, and I say long-term, we're talking about months now, in young children who've been infected or who were infected and got sick.
You've written that some people with long-term impacts may be irreversible, like the lung scarring, blood clots, risk of stroke, that sort of thing.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about the heart, and we don't know about whether it's going to lead to hearts that are weakened that won't work as well 10 or 20 years down the road. We just don't know the answer to that. But we do know the answer to questions about clotting, because COVID causes the body to not only have tremendous inflammation, but it causes clot formation. And those clots can break off and go to the lungs and damage the lungs permanently. And of course, if those clots break off and go to the brain, they cause a stroke. And that certainly can cause and often does cause permanent damage. So those are some major concerns, but also that tremendous inflammation that some people develop in their lungs when fighting off the virus leads to scar tissue. It's like if you get a bad cut, it leads to a scar. And that's happening in the lungs. And it's even happening in the lungs in people who aren't that sick sometimes. And we don't know what the long-term consequences will be of the amount of scar tissue in the lung. Certainly, we'd think that the less there is, the better. But will this cause breathing problems later in life? And the answer is we just don't know.
Is it too soon to know to what extent this virus could mutate?
It could mutate. The evidence that we have to date suggests that while it has mutated somewhat, it seems to be a virus that doesn't mutate very often or very much. And that is really good news. The changes that we've seen with this virus on a genetic level have been quite modest compared to other viruses like this coronavirus that tend to mutate more commonly and more quickly. So that portends some good things about drugs we may develop, and more importantly about vaccines we may develop.
And, you know, our first guest this hour talked about face masks and how they're engineered and what works and what doesn't. And but from a medical standpoint, I wondered if you could talk about what are legitimate exemptions that would excuse people from wearing a mask? Because people say, I can't wear a mask. We've heard that. We've seen the videos. Are there legitimate reasons why some people can't wear face masks?
There are, but they're very few. It's really interesting how the myths about face masks have spread so widely on the internet, and how susceptible people are to believing those myths. Certainly, people who have serious chronic lung disease may have more difficulty wearing the face mask. Although I must say that in years and years and years, decades of taking care of patients with severe chronic lung disease, they'd often have to wear a face mask because of infections they might have, and they tolerated it very well. But there may be certain circumstances where people are having trouble exchanging gases, like with chronic lung disease, that might merit that. Same thing for people with severe heart disease, where that could be a problem. But in general, face masks don't compromise people's ability to get air in, to exchange gases adequately. So it's a very small number of people.
Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks as always for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's always nice talking with you.
Dr. John Swartzberg is chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. And that's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.